there were no weapons of mass destruction over there. Misdirection right down here.
All right, that's the Reverend Lowry at the Coretta Scott King funeral making some of his comments that made the news. I just can't get my blood pressure up about that when I think there was a bigger problem going on than just saying rude things and embarrassing things to the president. I'm Todd Wilkin. This is Issues Etc. We're talking about that, getting your reaction to those comments and to the fact that virtually every public funeral now isn't a funeral. And so what do you expect people to say? They're going to say what they want to say. When you get up there and say, well, it's to speak well of the dead, what do you expect? 505-7850, 1-800-730-2727. Our in-studio email address is issuesetc@kfuo.org. We've got two issues on the table. The first, the King funeral and the comments that were made and what didn't get said, as far as I can tell. At that funeral, the message of the cross and the resurrection of Jesus Christ. And the other issue is this New Jersey Supreme Court decision that people are expecting tomorrow. The Supreme Court there is going to hear this case. They're going to hear arguments in this case that would legalize gay marriage in that state. Polls in New Jersey show that 55% of the voters support same-sex marriage. Many people expect, we heard from the NPR piece, that New Jersey will be the next state to allow for gay marriage, all the same reasons we've heard before with regard to Massachusetts. That's the other issue. 505-7850, 1-800-730-2727, and our in-studio email address, issuesetc@kfuo.org. Tomorrow on the program, Dr. Dean Wenthe, president of Concordia Theological Seminary, Fort Wayne, Indiana, is going to join us to talk about the worldview in the first 16 verses of the book of Romans. He's got a very interesting article, I think it's in the latest Modern Reformation magazine, on that subject. 505-7850, 1-800-730-2727. Now, did you think about it that way when you watched the news and everyone was playing these comments made at the King funeral? Did you think about it that way? Was I a little upset that the president was embarrassed? Did I consider it just terrible form to invite someone to speak and then to have other speakers say nasty things? Sure. But I had a harder time getting past the fact that this could have been a funeral for, this could have been a Muslim funeral. This could have been a Jewish funeral. This could have just been a memorial service held by atheists. It could have. As far as I could tell, and again, I didn't watch all 5 hours, there was nothing about this funeral that made it distinctly Christian. Yeah, there were lots of reverends up there. Certainly the cross and the resurrection, what I would consider to be the sine qua non, the very essence of what a Christian funeral ought to be about, not in evidence. Especially didn't make the news. That might have made the news. Someone actually would have preached the cross. And people probably would have been upset that they spent 1 minute talking about Jesus rather than focusing on Mrs. King. What do you think? 505-7850, 1-800-730-2727. All right. The next piece I've got for you is a very interesting conversation between Bob Abernathy of PBS's Religion and Ethics News Weekly and one of his guests on the Muslim reaction to these Danish cartoons. His guest is Dr. Sayed Hossein Nasser. He's professor of Islamic studies at George Washington University. Now, when we've watched the reaction of Muslims in the news to the Danish cartoons of Muhammad, we've been watching people being burned in effigy. We've been watching banners. We've been watching yelling, threats of violence. That's one picture of Islam. Here in this interview, a different picture of Islam. Pay very close attention to the answers that are given by this particular Muslim, Dr. Sayed Hossein Nasser, Islamic Studies at George Washington University. This is from PBS Religion and Ethics News Weekly.
Protests over cartoons published in Europe continued to spread across the Muslim world. In Iran, Lebanon, Syria, and elsewhere, angry crowds attacked European embassies and fought with police. Several civilians in Afghanistan were killed during protests. President Bush condemned the violence and suggested extremists were encouraging it. Worldwide, religious leaders called for calm. The spark that ignited those demonstrations was the publication last September in a newspaper in Copenhagen of 12 cartoons, many of them depicting the Prophet Muhammad. Muslims in Denmark found the cartoons insulting, even blasphemous, and complained to Muslim leaders in the Middle East. Sayed Hossein Nasser is professor of Islamic studies at George Washington University in Washington. Professor Nasser, welcome. How could 12 cartoons published in Denmark cause all this protest and all this violence?
We can only understand the relation between the cause and effect of this remarkable phenomenon, which seems illogical outwardly, by delving a bit more deeply into the conditions that are there. If you take a match right now, light it, and throw it into the woods in New Hampshire, nothing happens. But if you do the same in western Texas, you're going to have a major firestorm on your hands. For the last few decades, especially the last 20 years, the Islamic community in Europe, more than America, so to some extent in America, but more in Europe, has been feeling the pressure of what is sometimes called Islamophobia. That is, feeling as if they are under siege and under attack. Furthermore, not only is that true, but in the Islamic world itself, the larger Islamic world with 1,200,000,000-1,300,000 followers, most people feel as if their core values, what gives them identity, their spiritual and cultural orientation and moorings are being threatened by a civilization which is more powerful than it militarily, economically, and politically. Mm-hmm. And of course, the attacks of Iraq and Afghanistan, what went on in Chechnya, what has gone on in Palestine have helped this.
But it was also encouraged, wasn't it, by some leaders, some Muslim leaders?
By some governments. Mm-hmm. The religious leaders, very few, the leading religious leaders of Al-Azhar or other places did not encourage it. But by some governments, definitely. And that is, I think, a global phenomenon. Every government tries to make use of the sentiment of its people for its own political ends.
What about the alleged desecration of the Prophet Muhammad? Now, that people would understandably get upset about. But there are depictions of the Prophet. It's not banned in the Quran or anything like that, is it?
It's banned in the Hadith and also indirectly in the Quran. There are two different elements that are involved that oftentimes are mixed up together in the press. One is the actual depiction. One is the pejorative nature of it. Now, in Islamic history, there have been some miniatures, Persian, Turkish, and Mughal, India, not Arab, because the Semitic people are people especially sensitive toward images. Thou shalt not make a graven image, God told Moses. But in the non-Semitic part of the Islamic world, there have been miniatures. First of all, the face is either covered or is completely stylized. And I don't think anyone would have gotten excited in the Islamic world if something like that had been drawn in the Western press.
So what do we do now?
What we do now is on two levels. First of all, the fundamental principle is that we must have respect for each other. There must be mutual respect. The West must respect the Islamic world, and the Islamic world must respect the West. If the West's values are different from the Islamic world, as long as they don't impinge upon the Islamic world, it's their own business. They must be respected. But they must also be vice versa. And on the political level, I think it's very important for some of the major countries in both the West and the Islamic world to get together and try to quiet this down. Otherwise, there'll be very unforeseen and possibly tragic consequences for both Islamic world and the West.
All right, now there's the PBS and religion PBS Religion and Ethics News Weekly piece, and that was Bob Abernathy talking with Dr. Nasser of Washington University. His solution at the end, did you hear that? His solution is mutual toleration and understanding. Now, I was thinking at the end, look, if every adherent to Islam was like Dr. Nasser, that would be a reasonable solution to this. Because he seems like a reasonable man, willing to understand the West and willing to have Islam, at least on his terms, understood by the West. Seems like a reasonable solution. But not every Muslim is like Dr. Nasser. And that raises a question in my mind. Why? Or will the real Islam please stand up? Which is Islam? What we see taking place in the streets after Danish cartoons are drawn depicting Muhammad as a violent man, or Dr. Nasser sitting nicely in his clothes in the television studio speaking reasonably about mutual toleration? Or is the truth somewhere in between? This is what has confounded me ever since Islam was thrust back onto the stage for us to pay attention to again. Now we must pay attention to it. At our peril, we ignore what Islam is all about. And the question has yet to be answered, except by a few guests we've had here on this program and elsewhere. The question has yet to be answered, what is Islam? And which is the real Muslim? Which truly represents this religion? Dr. Nasser, sitting reasonably, quietly, calmly in a studio, or the Muslims we see threatening and carrying out violence? And, as Dr. Nasser would say, overreacting. That's how he described it, overreacting to these Danish cartoons. Which is which? And which is the real thing? Another thing I noted there, and I wonder what you think about it as well, when he was asked the question, have Muslim leaders encouraged the violence, the demonstrations, the burning of the Danish embassies? Well, he said, no, governments have. But we've talked about Islam a lot here on this program. And one thing that we've come back around to again and again and again is, at least where Islam is in a political majority, there is no distinction between mosque and state, between religious leaders and government. There's no distinction at all. Part of it is because of Sharia law. Sharia law is religious law that is imposed on people's civil conduct. And part of it is just the fact that the Muslim clerics speak louder than the politicians. So I come back around to this, and I'd like to know what you think. Which is the real Islam? If we don't answer this question, then we can't say we understand Islam, or much less its place in world events. Is it true that so-called radical Islam is the radical version, and that Western Islam is the real thing, the way it ought to be practiced, thought of, believed, pursued? 505-7850, 1-800-730-2727. So Dr. Nasser's explanation for why this happened, why such a violent reaction to Danish cartoons, he says, well, it's like throwing a match into dry kindling. What do you expect? And the kindling there in the Islamic world is dry because of, did you hear what he said? Islamophobia. It's a reaction to people who fear Islam. So if we simply understand one another, and the Muslims in Muslim countries believe that they're being properly understood by the West, will they all sit quietly in their chairs and have nice, reasonable conversations with us? 505-7850, 1-800-730-2727. It's open lines. We've been talking about Islam for, what, 3-4 years running now? And the question still remains. Let's talk with DB, calling from his car. Hi, DB.
Hey, I've been thinking about this question for the last few years, and I find it really difficult to answer because we can look at the historical roots of Islam and say, yes, it definitely has violent roots. We see that in Muhammad himself. But the problem is, how can you tell what the orthodox version, meaning what is the historical version of a religion that's false? I mean, I'm Presbyterian, you're Lutheran. We both hold to the inerrancy of Scripture, and we agree that there is an orthodox and accurate faith. We may disagree on what that is, but we say there is a Christianity which is true, which is orthodox, and we can debate that from the Word. But the problem with something like Islam is there can be such thing as an evolving religion because it's a false religion, and I don't know how you ever can quite really nail down what the true religion is, the true version of it is. We can say historically where it's at, but we can never, I don't know, it's kind of like nailing spaghetti to the wall.
Well, I think you're right there in a sense, DB, and thank you for the call. And thanks for your honesty, by the way, because, yeah, I mean, a thoroughgoing Presbyterian, a thoroughgoing Lutheran will agree, basically, that there is such a thing as a true Christian faith. We will disagree on what the shape of that true Christian faith is, to one degree or another, but we will basically agree that there is a true Christian faith. So DB says, what does it matter what real Islam is if this is what Islam is now? If this is what it is now, does it really matter what Islam is? And being a false religion, can we ever find out what it is in its truest form? Joe calls from his car. Hi, Joe.
Hi, Todd. My take on it was I'm not sure that the guy that was interviewed is any different in principle from the people who are out committing the acts of violence. He didn't condemn what they were doing. In fact, he sought to justify it by blaming governments or lack of understanding on other people. He did not assign any responsibility for what they were doing to themselves. Seems to me he's just an apologist for it. Just a not one who's setting fires. He's just a verbal apologist.
Thank you, Joe. Well, that's what it sounds like to me, too. But he would say, no, I'm not apologizing for it. I'm just trying to help, you know, he says his goal is mutual understanding and toleration. I'm just trying to help you, the Westerners, understand us, the Muslims, and why some of us would react this way. And if we did understand each other, I get that's the point he drives toward. If we did understand each other, then we wouldn't have these troubles. People wouldn't be drawing pictures of Muhammad the way they did, and then Muslims wouldn't have to react the way they did. Sandy's calling from Alton. Hi, Sandy.
Hi. Thanks for taking my call. Just some comments on the world situation in regard to, Islam, what it is, moderate Islam, radicalized. I was listening Sunday night to Coast to Coast. That's George Norrie, but then there was a segment in the conclusion of that evening in which around 4 o'clock it was the Art Bell segment, and he was talking with a gentleman, and I can't remember his name because I didn't jot it down at that time. It was his opinion. He had connection to the Islamic communities and had been studying this. It wasn't Dr. Morey. But anyway, Art Bell had asked him his opinion of what percent worldwide is Islam radicalized, and he posed, maybe 10%. And this guy said, probably about 70%. This gentleman had said that he had been recording Osama bin Laden's taking recordings of Osama bin Laden's messages over the last several years, and he was quoting one of his fairly recent, and his accusation toward the West, and especially America, was, I'm going to try to quote it, he called us cowards. He says, you have no sons. You have no children. He says, I think he said about 15 or 17 sons. He says, my father had so many, my grandfather, up to 70 sons, according to their culture. And he says, it is an honor. This is Osama bin Laden. It is an honor to martyr our son for Allah because he will go to paradise. How do you reason with this kind of mindset in a civilized world?
Sandy, thank you very much. Well, I mean, indeed. How do you? And the thing that concerns me the most, and we brought this up with guests as we've talked about Islam as recently as last week, we had a very interesting conversation from a contributor to Chronicles magazine, and I asked the question, if we fail to understand what Islam really is all about, and that's the question I'm posing to you, what is it really all about, will we ever be able to get a handle on the crisis that nationalized Islam, or now it's being called the Islamist movement, poses? If our president continues to say Islam is a religion of peace, And if, perhaps it isn't, how big of a miscalculation is that? Andy calls from Kirkwood. Hi, Andy.
Maybe that the president is saying one thing and meaning another.
I think that's likely.
But the two things, Todd, basically the Islamists who are doing the rioting are kind of irony impaired because what they're doing essentially is proving true what the caricaturist was depicting.
I like your term there, irony impaired. That is a failure to see that proving exactly what they object to. Thank you very much, Andy. Thanks for the call. 505-7850, 1-800-730-2727. It's open lines, issues, etc. We'll have 25 more minutes on the other side of this break, but we still have time before this break to talk with Roland, who's calling from his car. Hi, Roland.
Hey, Pastor. How are you?
Doing well.
What I find interesting is that you have a Muslim man talking about Islam in Western Christian terms. I don't know that tolerance is defined the same way in an Islamic view as it is in a Christian view.
That's very insightful, Roland.
Thank you.
Thank you. Thank you. Okay, let's look at it this way. we talk about Western Islam. Perhaps we should more accurately call it Westernized Islam. Okay, we've established that Christianity has held a tremendous influence over Western civilization, that the sensibilities of Western civilization, by and large, are close enough to Christianity to say, look, there's been a lot of influence here. So would a Westernized Muslim have sensibilities rooted in that kind of Christian capital that are foreign to Islam? Oh, I'm sorry. Andy's back from Kirkwood. Andy, with a follow-up?
The other thing I was going to say, Todd, is that they're pretending that this is not because that these were insulting cartoons, but that there was any depiction of the Prophet Muhammad would be an insult to their religion. But, you know, I don't recall any rioting taking place when they had that movie of Muhammad's life with Anthony Quinn.
No, I hadn't even thought about that. Thanks, Andy. Well, that little claim was disproven after about 10 hours in the news cycle, because reporters started looking around saying, hey, wait a minute, here's a picture of Muhammad, and here's a depiction of him on the wall of a mosque, and here he is over here. Now, Dr. Nasser's explanation in that Religion and Ethics News Weekly piece was, well, yes, in non-Arab countries, but the Arab countries are still very sensitive about depictions of Muhammad. Smartest listeners on radio. More opportunity for you to call on the other side of this break. Hang on the line. I'll get to you right after this. 505-7850, 1-800-730-2727. Our in-studio email address. You can just shoot a question or a comment to us right here in the studio, issuesetc@kfuo.org. Talking a little bit about what Islam really is, if the question can even be answered. Stay tuned.
Talk radio for the thinking Christian. You're listening to Issues, Etc.
Historical theology is not just a bunch of names and dates and fact. It's the study of Christ being faithful to his promises.
Dr. Larry Rast of Concordia Theological Seminary in Fort Wayne, Indiana, on the importance of historical theology.
Historical theology is the study of theology over the course of time, just like the title says, theology over the course of time. But that can lead some to think that this is a dry, kind of an abstract endeavor, when in fact what we're talking about with historical theology is the faithful confession ongoing through the church by people that Christ has called, seeing him fulfill the promise that he will never leave the church orphaned or forsaken.
For more information about Concordia Theological Seminary in Fort Wayne, Indiana, visit their website, www.ctsfw.edu.
This is Family News in Focus. I'm Bob Dittmer. A number of studies conclude that pornography is demeaning to women and harms adults who consume it. Now we're learning about the harm pornography does to children who are exposed to it. even accidental exposure to explicit sexual images can warp a child's view of sexuality and taint relationships well into adulthood. Steve Jordahl reports.
According to a survey of divorce lawyers, pornography is a factor in almost 2 of 3 divorces. Many of these marriages may have been doomed from the start because of a damaged view of sexuality formed as a child. Daniel Weiss, of Focus on the Family Action, says children accept the reality that they're presented with.
This possibly violent, very degrading image or depiction of sexuality becomes what the normal depiction of sexuality in the child's mind.
And it follows them through life. Experts say early exposure to pornography is associated with increased teen pregnancy, abuse, drug and alcohol use, and a host of relational problems. Often these problems arise after years of marriage as external beauty fades. Researcher Dr. Jeffrey Satinover.
The ability to see the human being on the inside and respond erotically requires that you not have set up and trained yourself in a set of completely artificial, impersonal expectations.
Counselor Joanne Condi says the abundance and accessibility of pornography makes it difficult for parents to shield their children from the danger.
The best thing that a parent can do, rather than just saying no to all those things, which of course offers some help, is to actually help that child process what is good and wholesome and healthy.
She says saying nothing about sexuality to your kids is just as dangerous as being too permissive. For Family News in Focus, I'm Steve Jordahl.
Weiss says there isn't a lot of research on pornography's harm to kids because it would be unethical to conduct such studies. For Family News in Focus, I'm Bob Dittmer.
Hi, this is Dr. Bob Weiss inviting you to join me at Trinity Lutheran Church, Edwardsville, Illinois, for a seminar titled Cloning and Stem Cell Research. I'll explore the scientific, political, and theological implications of these controversial topics. That's Sunday, February 26th at 6 p.m. in the sanctuary of Trinity Lutheran Church, 600 Water Street, Edwardsville.
Are the visions and oracles found in the Old Testament book of Ezekiel relevant to God's people today? Our Issues Etc. book of the month for February is the Concordia Commentary on Ezekiel. It's published by Concordia Publishing House. Their phone number, 1-800-325-3040, 1-800-325-3040. Or you can get more information about this commentary on our website, issuesetc.org. The Concordia Commentary on Ezekiel, our February Book of the Month.
Welcome back to Issues Etc. I'm Todd Wilkin. Open lines. Got a couple things on the table. We've got the Reverend Joseph Lowry's comments at the Coretta Scott King funeral. Your general reaction to that from last week. Also, there's a New Jersey Supreme Court decision that is expected after the case is heard tomorrow on whether or not that state will be ratifying gay marriage. And the one that our callers are most interested in has to do with the Muslim reaction to these Danish cartoons, and an interview that we played from PBS's Religion and Ethics News Weekly, a Muslim scholar here in the U.S., saying, look, if we understood each other a little better, tolerated each other a little bit better, these kind of things wouldn't happen. It's audio open lines. Our call-in number is 505-7850, 1-800-730-2727. I ask the question, which is the real Muslim, the one in the streets or the one sitting quietly and reasonably in the PBS studios? 505-7850-1-800-730-2727, our in-studio email address, issuesetc@kfuo.org. Up next, David from Illinois. Hi, David.
Hello. It is my belief that if Islam would be in power or near power here in the United States, they would be rioting. They would force their religion on us. That's my belief. And I think that is shown in Europe, where they have been very lenient with the protests, but maybe Europe is now waking up to that problem. And it seems to me that Islam needs a major reformation from within. And if they don't do that, then the war that we are fighting in Iraq, which I believe is a religious war, will expand. And I think it'll expand, you know, worldwide.
It'll spread global.
Yes.
All right. David, thank you very much. Dr. John Warren Montgomery, very shortly after September 11th, if you will remember, came on our program, and he said, look, where, and I think this has been proven true as we've examined more closely and more closely over the last several years Islam in the world, where Islam is in a political majority, it demonstrates itself, it presents itself very differently than when it's in a political minority. His case in point, look at Muslims in the West and Muslims in Islamic countries. It looks like two different religions. Why? He says it's because when in the political minority, largely they follow Muhammad's example. When he was in the minority and lacked the wherewithal to make war, he was very diplomatic. He was very careful, even with his enemies. When he had the wherewithal to make war and win, he was militant. And I think it's a pretty good working theory until a better one comes along. That was Dr. John Warwick Montgomery on this program not too long ago. Thanks, David, for the call. Let's talk with Barry, who listens in Washington, D.C. Hi, Barry.
Todd, I feel like I'm in an odd situation today. I'm going to respectfully disagree with Dr. Montgomery.
All right, let's hear it.
I think he's oversimplifying things. I have the privilege of going to Iran several times a year and also to Persian Gulf countries and to discuss comparative theology with their religious leaders. I am allowed to discuss Jesus Christ on Iranian national television, and they're very kind about it. Also, the two Islams, you can hear them. They alternate. The main mosque, or the Jami Mosque, which is the congregational mosque in Tehran, alternates between two leaders, Jannati on 1 week, Rafsanjani on the next. Jannati hates the U.S. and is militantly Islamic. Rafsanjani likes the U.S. and preaches kindness and compassion and don't get upset about the cartoons. So in a country where they're in the majority, you have two distinct camps.
So let me see if I can clearly understand what you're saying here.
Yes.
Do you completely reject Montgomery's notion that whether or not Islam holds a political majority in a state makes a difference as to how it presents itself? Or are you simply saying, look, we've got what we've got in many other religions. You've got peaceful Hindus. You've got militant Hindus. You've got peaceful Muslims. You've got militant Muslims.
No. It's even more than that, Tom.
Really?
What I'm really talking about is that Islam is submission to God, the God of the Quran. The majority of Muslims in the West are not truly in submission to their God as stated in the Quran, just like the majority of Christians in the United States do not clearly follow the true and inerrant word of the Scripture.
So if they did, if Western Muslims did, what would Islam look like here, in your opinion?
I find that the ones who most firmly believe the Quran and take it most literally, now Iran's a Shia country, so their Shia beliefs, the ones who most strongly believe those beliefs, are the ones most likely to follow the current president, hate the United States, want to burn Danish embassies and torture Danish people. And I see that over and over again. And the ones who are most moderate, even in Iran, they just had a presidential race. 65% voted for the new president. 35% voted for former President Rafsanjani, who is a pro-Western. He's a more Western style in his Islam. And I think that's about two-thirds are very literal in their interpretation of the Quran, and about one-third take a more moderate, less submissive view.
Hey, Barry, do you mind me asking what you do for a living that requires you to travel to Iran?
Well, actually, I'm not required at all. I go over on vacation. I'm a computer consultant, and I do political consulting and computer consulting, but I'm also one of the top experts in the world on Oriental carpets, and I do that as a hobby. I go over at the invitation of the Iranian government to lecture to their carpet producers on how to better make carpets to preserve their heritage. It's a huge thing. So I have a privileged position. I mean, they love me over there because I'm over there helping them, and I take no money for it. I won't accept any money for them. But I'm forced to go back because the last time I was in there, well, one trip, I flew in for 2 days. I did two national TV interviews 7 press interviews and who knows how many newspaper interviews, and I got to mention Jesus Christ in every one of them. So as long as I could get to mention Jesus, I'm forced to go back.
Well, no, you're making the best of an opportunity, and you have what sounds like a pretty rare opportunity there. Barry, thank you very much for the call, and as usual, thanks for listening up there in D.C. You know, I'm listening to Barry, and I just say this as a joke because I don't think this is true. Barry's being honest with us, but boy, would that be a cover for working in the intelligence community. Hey, I'm just there to talk about carpets. No offense, Barry, I'm just saying it occurred to me at the moment, but what an opportunity. What an opportunity. So he finds, even in Iran, the two Islams. What about the rest of you? 505-7850, 1-800-730-2727. He does concur with, or at least provide part of an answer to the question, which is the real Islam? And if Islam is stricter in its adherence to the Quran and the traditional teachings of Islam, it's an uglier picture. 505-7850, 1-800-730-2727. One of the most sinister characters in Dan Brown's book, The Da Vinci Code, which is coming out this summer as what is sure to be a blockbuster film, is Opus Dei, not a person, but a shadowy organization, an organization in the Roman Catholic Church. Few know much about it because it is rather secretive. And with the resurgence of the popularity of the Da Vinci Code because the movie's coming out, ABC News did a piece on Opus Dei and the Da Vinci Code, getting some reaction from that organization to the Da Vinci Code. Here's that piece from ABC News.
Now to the controversy surrounding the hotly anticipated movie The Da Vinci Code and the secretive Catholic group called Opus Dei. The movie opens in America on May 19th and depicts Opus Dei as a powerful cult involving bloody rituals. As the New York Times reported on Tuesday, Opus Dei is already so concerned that it has launched a preemptive public relations strike. And ABC's Dan Harris joins us now. And Dan, this is something else.
It is. Robin, good morning. Opus Dei is a small Catholic group with a reputation for secrecy, but the group is now going public in a big way, trying to use all the negative attention it's getting from the Da Vinci Code in its favor to spread its message and to show the world what it calls the real Opus Dei.
When the Da Vinci Code movie comes out in May, likely portraying Opus Dei as a murderous cult, the group will counter with this video.
My job is to find holiness and to bring holiness into ordinary circumstances.
At its headquarters in Manhattan, Opus Dei has now put out a box of informational literature for fans of the Da Vinci Code. And one of its members in Rome has a new website dedicated to making fun of the book.
The Da Vinci Code is a comedy of errors. You'd probably be better off, you know, watching Monty Python and the Holy Grail for all the information that you get from the Da Vinci Code.
The book and movie feature an albino Opus Dei monk named Silas, a deadly assassin who ritualistically beats himself. Some Opus Dei members do in fact hit themselves as a reminder of Jesus' pain, but they say they never hurt themselves and that this is an ancient Catholic tradition practiced by people such as Mother Teresa. Opus Dei gave us these pictures of the man it calls the real Silas, a stockbroker from Brooklyn. The group says he's one of 3,000 American members, all regular, hardworking people. Kathy Hickey, a mother of 7, is also a member.
Opus Dei is for ordinary people, you know, to sanctify their ordinary life and to really live good lives and raise good families and normal people.
Opus Dei, which means God's work in Latin, runs charity programs and gives its members coaches to help them become everyday saints. This small group does seem to have outsized influence. Their U.S. headquarters costs $70 million. The Pope's chief spokesman is a member. And the group's founder was quickly named a saint only 27 years after he died.
I think they are a force inside the church. They're probably a growing force. But on the other hand, they are simply one among many, many organizations that play some role in determining the direction of the church.
Some former Opus Dei members have accused the group of being a cult which controlled their lives and even checked their mail. An Opus Dei spokesman told me that the group did at one time check the mail of some people who lived in its facilities, but they no longer do so. The group strongly denies, Robin, that it is a cult.
But they're being serious about this, getting out ahead of the movie that opens in May.
Indeed.
Well, I mean, talk about a preemptive strike. That is. I mean, you got a movie that's not going to be out for several months, and Opus Dei is already saying, look, let's set the record straight on what we're all about. It's a little difficult when you're a secretive organization, but there may be a good reason for this. Now, as far as I can tell, and we've talked with people about Opus Dei before, there's some mystery there. But by their own description, I think we've talked with Dr. James Hitchcock about Opus Dei before. By their own admission, they're really about what Lutherans would call vocation. They're about taking seriously your daily calling as a Roman Catholic and bringing your Roman Catholic faith, so to speak, to work with you. In many ways, it's kind of a reaction against Roman Catholic monasticism. Now, do you plan to see the Da Vinci Code movie? I was just talking about it when we were listening to that piece with Craig, and he said, did you read the book? I said, yeah, but I didn't enjoy it the way so many people did. And it's not because I disagreed with it. I just couldn't suspend disbelief long enough to enjoy it as a thriller. And people who have read it say, who read it otherwise say, hey, it was a great thriller. And I'm sure it is. I just couldn't suspend disbelief long enough to get into it to enjoy it that way. So the movie, yeah, I'm going to see it. I have to see it. But are you going to see it? Knowing what you know about the Da Vinci Code? 505-7850, 1-800-730-2727. Steve calls from his car. Hi, Steve.
Hey, I'll buy it on the funeral.
Okay.
You know what's interesting? And, you know, I look at it this way. Given the nature of how political things are, you know, Bush should have known better. And that's just the way things are. But what I find interesting is the fact that you have this person, basically, the church has become a civil rights organization, the black community. You had G. James Kennedy basically trying to wrap Abe Lincoln in the cross. And what happens is that from both sides, you know, you can call one liberal, one conservative, but they're both ending up the same place. They're both ending up basically counting people over Christ. And it's just humanism wrapped up with church words.
I think you're right. In both cases, it is. Had they lauded the president at the Coretta Scott King funeral and said marvelous things about him and given him a Coretta Scott King award or something like that at the funeral, in my mind, it would have amounted to exactly the same thing.
Right. And the fact that is with most of these big name preachers, they're looking on. They spend more time looking at the Nielsen ratings than they do at the Bible.
Agreed, Steve. Thank you very much. Well, what is it that somehow we see it during presidential campaigns too? When we get presidential candidates showing up places on Sunday morning, and I don't fault the politician for asking to be invited into the pulpit. I mean, politicians will take any opportunity they can. Part of what being a politician is, to get their message out and get their face in front of people. That's their job. I fault the preacher who lets them do it, right or left. 505-7850, 1-800-730-2727. So someone had something to say, Steve, about the Coretta Scott King funeral. Now, he said there at the beginning the president should have known better. And I was thinking about that, too. Now, this is just my opinion. But I'm thinking if I'm an advisor to the president, he can't not go. And he wouldn't want to phone it in like he would at some other event, just say, I'll appear via video camera, because then it looks like it's not a priority to him. And I think he knew full well going in what was going to happen. They look at the cast of characters, and they know what's going to be said. And they probably calculated it was better for him to be there and take the abuse in front of the cameras than not to. Now, had it really been a funeral, he wouldn't have had to worry about it. Had they really been preachers of the Gospels in that pulpit for 5 hours, I wouldn't have minded that. The president wouldn't have had to worry about it because they wouldn't have been talking about Coretta Scott King and they wouldn't have been talking about him. They would have been preaching Christ. 10,000 people in that church. 10,000 people. That's how much it seats in that church. these preachers standing in that pulpit, one after another. They had the Bushes back there. They had the Clintons back there. They had President Bush's father back there. They had Jimmy Carter back there. Talk about an opportunity to preach before kings and princes. And they didn't. Here's Matt from Palm Bay, Florida. Hi, Matt.
Hi, Todd. Good afternoon.
Good afternoon to you, too.
You got two good topics. One of them is there's no way that George Bush's handlers couldn't have known what was going to happen.
Yeah. Oh, sure.
There's no way.
They're smart people. These guys know what they're doing.
Yeah, and I'm just wondering if they thought that it was really that important for him. I mean, I guess, you know, him being the president and her being Coretta Scott King, it's important that he be there.
I mean, unless he's got something that in terms of, you know, presidential duties and priorities that really outweigh this, he does have to be there.
Like a major terrorist attack.
Well, yeah, but
away.
But he does have to be there, and I say that with no guile. He needs to be there because we are talking about someone who is woven into the fabric of American history and American society.
Yeah, I'm just wondering if his handlers were thinking, I wonder what we can do with this if he does get attacked. Because there's
that's what handlers get paid to do.
Yeah.
what else did you have to say, Matt?
Well, about seeing the Da Vinci Code.
Yeah.
Yeah, I've got to see it. Not because I think it's wonderful or, I mean, I think for a couple of hours I could probably suspend disbelief enough to go, hey, this is, it'd probably be well made.
Oh, it's going to be very well made.
It's Ron Howard, and he's made two really good movies so far with this same crew.
And it's starring Tom Hanks.
Starring Tom Hanks. You probably couldn't miss with most of that. But the main reason that I've got to know what people are seeing, because it's just like today I spent like 3 hours sitting in a car dealership, and it just somehow or other we got around on biblical topics. And if I didn't know the things that he was coming to me with, he goes to a local evangelical church that's really kind of loose. If I didn't know those things, I wouldn't know how to answer him. So with the Da Vinci Code, I mean, I know the book, but I've got to know the movie, too, because a lot of people are going to see this thing.
And more people will see the movie than ever will read the book.
And they'll wind up reading the book, too, and they'll worry, and then we'll have to know how to answer their objections as they come up. Well, it says in the Da Vinci Code, or I saw in the movie.
Well, and, you know, that is a kind of a crucial turning point, and thank you very much, Matt. That's a crucial turning point for addressing the issues raised by this movie. Because it's one thing for Dan Brown to say, here's my book, and every chapter begins with fact. Fact, this or that. And for Dan Brown to assert, as he has, and we played it here on the air, to assert that the only thing fictional in the Da Vinci Code are the characters. That's one thing. You put it up on the silver screen, and some people will believe it because they see it compellingly presented on the screen, and some people will say, that was just a movie. And where those of us who see the errors in something like the Da Vinci Code can say to the average person, you know, it is just a movie. And they'll say, hey, yeah, it is. It's as fictional as King Kong. We'll certainly be talking about it again. 505-7850, 1-800-730-2727, coming up in just about 10 minutes. We'll be joined here in Studio A by Dr. Martin Noland to talk about St. Valentine, the real St. Valentine, on this Valentine's Day. Let's talk with Jerry from South County. Hi, Jerry.
Yeah, hi, Todd. Well, first of all, I lived in Turkey for almost 9 years in the 70s.
Turkey, you say?
Yeah,
all right.
The early 70s, 69 to 77, and with my husband there. And actually, Turkey has even become – Turkey was not a militant nation there in Islamic terms. It was a moderate, and people wore proper clothing as they do in the West, none of this black stuff and burqa stuff. And actually, Turkey is becoming more moderate, more militant now, I'm realizing and hearing news and that, because they have a fundamentalist Islamic, more of a religious, a political person there in charge of, president or whatever. And also, the thing is, the fellow who called about Iran, I've never been to Iran, of course, but see, they do, you know, the Muslims do believe that Jesus was a prophet, just like Moses. So if he spoke about Jesus, it does not mean that they believe that Jesus was our Savior. They just accept him.
Huh? Well, Jerry, you're right, and thank you for the call. I don't think Barry, the caller she's referring to, was asserting that somehow, you know, he was converting en masse Muslims by talking about Jesus and bearing witness to what Jesus has done. That, of course, is going to be received by a Muslim, notwithstanding the work of the Holy Spirit. That's going to be received by a Muslim as nice things said about a very nice prophet. Sure. Now, as to your first point, Dr. Alvin Schmidt was recently on the program, and we talked about Islam again, and he made the very point that you made about Turkey. He said that Turkey has been slowly, from its founding by Ataturk, slowly moving toward an Islamist direction, and more so in the last decade or so. So your observations there, Jerry, are at least confirmed by Dr. Schmidt's observations. LCMS World Relief, you know, one of the places where Islam has been a bit of a problem, and a little later in time, Muslims have been the victims of religious persecution, is the Sudan. First, they were the persecutors of the southern Christians, and then they became the persecuted when the political change took place in that country. Now, Christians and Muslims together in the Darfur region in the west, suffering religious persecution and political persecution. LCMS World Relief is bringing care to both and the gospel to both. Christ-centered, cross-focused relief efforts there in the Sudan and many other places at home and abroad. LCMS World Relief cares for both body and soul. They underwrite issues, etc. You can find out more about them at our webpage. Their logo is right there at issuesetc.org. Or you can call and donate and help. 1-888-930-4438. That's the toll-free number for LCMS World Relief. 1-888-930-4438. When we come back from this break, Dr. Martin Noland here in Studio A. He's director of the Concordia Historical Institute. We'll talk about St. Valentine on this Valentine's Day. Then Dr. Gene Smith joins us for part 5 of our 6-part series on Eastern Orthodoxy. We'll talk about Orthodoxy and the liturgy.
Listen weekday afternoons to Issues Etc. Issues Etc. is a listener-supported program. Your financial support is critical for the continuation and expansion of this worldwide outreach. Our address is 85 Founders Lane, St. Louis, Missouri, 63105. You can donate by credit card on our resource line, 1-800-737-0172, 1-800-737-0172. For a free audio copy of this hour of Issues Etc., please visit the audio archive section at kfuo.org. Opinions expressed are not necessarily those of AM 850 KFUO. Issues Etc. is a broadcast service of the Lutheran Church, Missouri Synod.